Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want. Your weekly movement news roundup.
You're with Give the People What They Want. This is our 171st episode, edging towards 200, Zoe. Weeks to go, really, in one sense. Less than a year for 200th episode. That's going to be a bumper episode, no doubt about that. Give the People What They Want, brought to you by People's Dispatch today. That's Zoe. We're waiting for Prashant to come back. You know that he's an important part of our little trinity here. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. Really happy to be with you today because it's important for us to start the show by talking about the fact that some good news in the world. Our colleague, our comrade, our friend, Probir Purkayastha, was released from Rohini jail earlier this week. Probir Purkayastha was persecuted as a consequence of being the editor of a kindred news site, which is NewsClick. NewsClick was founded in 2009. NewsClick, from 2009, began to report from India on news in West Asia. It was a very interesting experiment initially because the idea was, can we produce news on an analysis on West Asia from India? What is an Indian perspective regarding the pressure campaign on Iran? What is the Indian perspective regarding the US illegal war against Iraq and so on? So that was the origin of NewsClick in 2009. Over the course of the decade since then, NewsClick grew as a consequence of the support of millions of viewers. People wanted to understand what's going on within India, what's happening with the people's movements. The big strikes that had started in the 2000s were not being reported. There were 200 million workers going on strike in these annual rolling strikes against austerity. There was almost no coverage in the television media and virtually no coverage in the print media. Very important that NewsClick started to report the strike actions of workers, made connections with trade unions, people's movements, social movements, rational movements, and so on. And it was NewsClick that started, therefore, to report with great sincerity and enthusiasm the big protest wave against the Citizenship Amendment Bill, a bill that would have made Indian Muslims effectively second-class citizens. It was NewsClick that covered from the fields, from the roadways, the massive farmers' protest year that the farmers sat at the outskirts of Delhi. It was NewsClick journalists that were there staying with the farmers, reporting with honesty, providing the farmers' viewpoints to the general public. The viewership of NewsClick increased astronomically. Then NewsClick was also reporting on the COVID pandemic once more with enormous care and concern for the Indian public. This was, of course, intolerable for the Indian government, which then began a crackdown against NewsClick in February 2021, eventually arresting Probir Purkayastha, the chief editor of NewsClick, the founder of NewsClick, on October 3rd, 2023. For almost 6.5, 7 months, Probir Purkayastha was in Rohini jail. He was charged under terrorism offenses, very ridiculous charge that he faced. Mr. Purkayastha was charged this, but the only evidence against him, because there's no material evidence, were the statements made by protected witnesses. That's the only evidence that the state was able to marshal against him. That is to say, evidence provided by people who worked with Mr. Purkayastha but were being intimidated by the police to effectively make up evidence that would sustain a terrorism charge. Well, the Supreme Court of India decided this week that, in fact, the question, the merits of the case, the protected witnesses' statements and so on, were not germane to what they were looking at. They were merely looking at the fact that Mr. Purkayastha had not been arrested in a correct way. His remand notice was not given to him and so on. So therefore, he was released. This doesn't mean that the case against him has been wiped out. It doesn't mean that the pressure campaign against NewsClick will lessen. Of course, it does mean, Zoe, and this is important, it does mean that Mr. Purkayastha is out of prison. A 76-year-old man who sat in his prison cell, read a number of books about history, about the development of the world economy, wrote a text on sugar and the enslavement of human beings. When he left the prison, he left all his clothes for his fellow prisoners. He didn't take any of his clothes or supplies out. In his bag, he only had his books and his notes towards the article that he's working on. That's all he took out with him. This is a gem of a person who came out with his fist in the air. He was greeted by a number of people, well-wishers, comrades of his, people from NewsClick and so on, greeting him at the gates of Rohini prison. Now, all of this happens as the Indian election toward the Indian parliament is at a halfway stage. It is, of course, already clear that the ruling government, the Bharatiya Janata Party-led government of Mr. Narendra Modi, is unlikely to make gains. In fact, by some indicators, they will be weakened and could be grievously weakened. So we shall see. The atmosphere in India is towards, even perhaps some people, I think perhaps a little enthusiastically, are saying it might be a defeat for the BJP. Whatever it might be, a case on terrorist grounds is a political case. And I think the police are also aware that they don't want to necessarily rearrest him on this charge in the middle of the election campaign. We shall see. The election will continue, several phases more of voting to come. But of course, Mr. Purkayastha was not just arrested by the Delhi police. He's not just being persecuted by the Indian government. The trigger for the October 3rd arrest, Zoe, was in New York City. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, well, it is interesting. The New York Times actually specifically provided essentially the smoking gun in a sense, because it, you know, the paper of record, we know the New York Times has enormous amounts of prestige across the world. And it published, as we reported several months ago, essentially a hit piece against people like Prabir Purkayastha, against NewsClick, against a host of other progressive organizations, and slandering them and saying that they, for presenting a different, you know, perspective on the world and geopolitics, one which actually looks with excitement to the fact that the U.S. Is finally not the only country with, you know, ability to make loans to the global south and impose their ridiculous conditions. The fact that China, with the largest economy in the world, actually might be an actor that could potentially shift global politics. But of course, all of these sort of entities which are accused of being agents of China just for suggesting the fact that its mere existence is not a negative thing in itself. This has continued. And what's really interesting is that as we see that the New York Times essentially is responsible for why Prabir Purkayastha was in prison for 7 months, I mean, we did see members of the BJP government on the parliament floor essentially hoisting up the New York Times to say, and this is why we have to go after them. This article and further such attacks, these allegations saying that people who have, again, just a different viewpoint on geopolitics must be agents. This has continued. And, you know, several days after Prabir's arrest, another historic process began, or perhaps the intensification of an ongoing process, which was October 7th and the beginning of what was and now is the genocide, Israel's genocide in Gaza. And as we know, and as we've been reporting on this show week after week, there has been an outpouring of support for the Palestinian cause, and in what the ruling class might have thought, in unlikely locations. So it's not just Muslim countries across the world that are, you know, rallying in defense of the Palestinian cause, which may be what they see as normal. But actually in the imperial core, we've seen, again, massive protests, movement that is organized, that's disciplined, that has been going on the streets day after day. New York City has been an epicenter of this action. And as we have been reporting for the past couple of weeks and now months, the student encampments, again, a huge burst of energy in this movement. And at the very institutions which the US government and the ruling class considered sort of their own training grounds. So feeling betrayed, they've really lashed out and gone on this ridiculous offensive, saying that these student protests were organized by outside agitators, that there must be some suspicious connection to whether it's China, whether it's resistance groups in Palestine, whether it's X, Y, or Z, threatening power in some sort of way. They've done their best to really malign what is truly the most, pure expression of solidarity, of this human instinct to do whatever you can when you see that there's a genocide going on, to take whatever action possible. And actually this morning, I was catching up on the CNN report on the violent attacks by allegedly pro-Israel supporters on the UCLA encampment, which took place on April 30th, I believe. Horrific, horrific images of violence, of people taking long poles and sticks and pieces of wood and beating up students, attempting to cause maximum physical harm to not only the encampment and dismantling it, but actually to their own, to the bodies of these students. It's truly horrifying. And the CNN report revealed that these are people in their 50s. These are people of no affiliation whatsoever to UCLA. Yet somehow all of the reporting on the student encampments, on the protests of people who are just coming out in massive numbers to the streets to demand an end to the genocide, somehow they're the people who are outside agitators. Somehow they're the ones in the wrong. And you literally have people who are, trying to cause significant physical damage against student protesters. By the way, have not made any arrests in those cases. They have not even considered the evidence that CNN uncovered through merely 2 weeks of investigative reporting, when, of course, you have police bodies that could be serving the same purpose to actually, dole out some sort of, consequences for the violence that was unleashed. All that to say, it's a dizzying moment where the ruling class is really trying to respond to this outpouring of mass mobilization that they're really not used to for this cause. As we know, Israel is, and the Zionist project is central to US imperialism, so it is really an existential threat that this core policy is being challenged. And just to add to that, I'll just say one more thing, is that this mass movement that has erupted across North America over the past several months is an unprecedented moment in US history and Canadian history. There is going to be a conference next weekend in Detroit, Michigan, bringing together a lot of the forces that have been on the streets day after day, week after week. Of course, the Students for Justice in Palestine, this national network of student organizations that's been pushing these encampments, the Palestinian Youth Movement, the Answer Coalition, many, many different forces from the anti-imperialist movement, from the Palestinian and Arab movements in the United States are all going to be coming together in Detroit. It's going to be a really important moment of catalyzing these forces and building further unity. As we know, we've been following the events in Palestine. Ceasefire looked like it was a possibility, looked like we were getting closer last week, but Israel once again shoving it to the side. And so this movement is very, very important to continue putting pressure on the US to shift its policy.
That's absolutely correct. And it looks like normally, you had a situation where students would do protests in the spring semester, go off in the summer, and things would temper down. Looks like that's not going to happen. There's a lot of energy that's going to come to that conference in Detroit, and then let's see what happens beyond that. I think that's important. You're with Give the People What They Want, brought to you from People's Dispatch. Today, that's Zoe. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. Really happy to be with you. Of course, the students are protesting the Israeli bombardment in Gaza itself. Very interesting developments. Firstly, the South Africans have gone back to the International Court of Justice to demand that Israel not enter the Rafah region in the south of Gaza. Over 630,000 Palestinians have fled the neighborhoods around Gaza where they had set up tent cities, some of them going towards the coastal area, little enclaves where they hope that they'll have some kind of security, but you know, there's no guarantee of this. In fact, while there's been all eyes on Rafah in the south, while people have been going out on the street around the world in the encampments and so on and saying no attack on Rafah, while all that has been happening, the Israelis have intensified bombardment in the north of Gaza. It's gone by quite unremarked. In fact, they've been hitting Jabalia refugee camp, which is north of Gaza City, very, very hard. They just killed 6 people last night. Now, the character of these attacks on Jabalia is interesting. You see, initially the Israelis entered Gaza City and they went into Jabalia to try to, as they said it, eradicate Hamas. Then they moved down to Khan Yunis and eventually to the borders of Rafah City in the southern part of Gaza. But they at the same time said they've accomplished their mission in the north. So the question rises, why are the Israelis hitting Jabalia refugee camp so hard in the last few days? Why have they been bombing certain kinds of institutions? And I'm going to talk about why these institutions were hit so hard. But that's been an issue. Why Jabalia? Why certain targets being hit? What is going on? And by the way, civil defense people who had moved south in anticipation of the attack on Rafah cannot get back up north. We have very little awareness of exactly what's been happening. But what is already clear is that the Israelis have been hitting buildings that have housed social service agencies and NGOs. That means that the very infrastructure, the social infrastructure that has enabled people in this large refugee camp to survive, you know, the medical facilities, the prenatal care facilities, the schools, the places for disabled children to get special education, special needs children to have help from certain kinds of NGOs and agencies. The Israelis are decimating all these buildings. They are trying effectively to make northern Gaza, particularly the Jabalia camp, which is one of the poorest regions in the north of Gaza, to make it uninhabitable. So very targeted attacks taking place in the north. So as I say, while the attention is focused on the south, what's happening in the north is extremely important. In the north, as investigators have been able to go there, people from the various Red Crescent societies, from, you know, some UN agencies, other agencies, as they've gone up there, they have uncovered, with the help of civil defense volunteers, mass graves. There are now 130 documented mass graves in northern Gaza. That means, what is a mass grave? A mass grave is where more than one or two people are thrown in and buried without any consideration of their individuality and humanity. Bodies just thrown upon bodies and dirt thrown on them to disappear people. There are so far 10,000 missing people. The number of official dead is over 35,000, but there are 10,000 missing. With the existence of 130 mass graves, hundreds of people have been thrown into these graves by the Israeli forces. Each one of these is a war crime. That's 130 war crimes. In the north, the war continues. In the north, the mass graves are being discovered. People have taken their eyes off the north to focus quite rightly on the potential violation of the rights of over a million people in Rafah City. But the war continues. It's very important that we not forget to see what is happening to the thousands of people that didn't move south. They continue to be targets of mass Israeli bombardment. Zoe, that's happening in the north. Of course, this is something the students have been aware of. atrocities continue. Murders continue. So do assassinations. Let's go to Honduras, another place. History of assassinations and murders.
An unfortunate update. So, you know, a couple of years ago, 2018, November, we joined, you know, organizations across the world, really, in saluting the conviction of the murderers of Berta Cáceres. Berta Cáceres was assassinated on March 2nd, 2016. She was a fearless revolutionary who was fighting in her country against extractive projects that were financed by some of the biggest banks in the world, some of the largest multinational companies. She fought and organized with the indigenous people in Honduras against these projects and really against the coup government in Honduras that was tearing down the environmental regulations and really opening up the country for business, for sale, as we know that happened during the 12 years of the coup government in Honduras following the coup d'etat in 2009. Berta was assassinated in 2016, and this assassination again sent sort of a shockwave across the region, across Honduras, across the world. She was someone who was so well recognized. She won the Goldman Prize. She was, you know, recognized across the region. She met the Pope. This was someone you thought, okay, she's receiving a lot of threats, but they won't dare to touch her because just of the level of visibility she has. But the Honduran state, in collusion with the company that was bringing forward the project, in a very intricate web of this criminal masterminds, members of the Honduran kind of ruling families, essentially hatched a plan to have her assassinated. A lot of the details of the assassination have been uncovered due to independent investigations. You know, they had planned a first version of this and it didn't work. They had to come back. And in 2018, as I said, many people across the world were very happy to learn that those who actually executed this assassination, the hitmen that were hired, were convicted. A year later, David Castillo, who was the executive of DESA, which was the company that was bringing forward this hydroelectric project, he was one of the masterminds of the crime who consistently threatened Berta, who was the person really on the ground, but also in connection with these higher levels of the Honduran ruling class of the government, and doing this direct coordination. He was arrested and put in prison. And now, 8 years after this crime, in a long, long struggle of justice, all of these achievements are at risk. And COPIN, the Council of Civic and Popular and Indigenous Organizations of Honduras, has essentially launched a campaign to make sure that actually justice is delivered and confirmed. There is a risk of that David Castillo and other people who are convicted in this case, that they're trying to essentially lobby for their release, saying that their conviction was made under false pretenses, that there was falsified evidence. They interestingly don't have any evidence to actually substantiate these claims. However, the Supreme Court has yet to ratify their sentences. And so once again, COPIN has launched this campaign demanding justice in this case. As they pointed out many times throughout the case, it's not just about justice for one person, but it's really about breaking the impunity that reigned over the country for many years. This sort of impunity we can see in many countries across the world, especially in the Global South, where transnational corporations are essentially given a free license by governments such as the former government in Honduras that was under the National Party rule. Of course, the National Party still has significant influence in many different institutions of the government. We know that when progressive governments win in the elections, there continues to be a battle within the institutions of who controls them. And so again, this is an ongoing campaign, an ongoing struggle. As COPIN has reiterated many, many times, the struggle for justice is a very long one. It's a tiring one. They have continued to fight for justice for Berta, to fight for justice for the Honduran people. But it's important that we keep our eyes on Honduras as this important struggle continues.
That's Honduras. Moving, of course, across the Atlantic, in Slovakia, the Slovakian Prime Minister, Robert Fico, was shot and injured, grievously injured by what the government now calls a lone wolf attacker. It's an interesting moment for Slovakia. The outgoing president, Zuzana Kaputova, made an important statement saying that there's a kind of poisonous culture on social media where people have been attacking Mr. Fico for his various political views. Mr. Fico used to be a member of the Communist Party. Over the course of the end of Czechoslovakia, the breaking of it into the Czech Republic and the Slovak Republic, Mr. Fico fashioned himself as a social democrat, brought the Slovak Republic into an alliance with the Europeans, is on track in a way to enter the various European institutions. But at the same time, Mr. Fico has been very close to neighboring Russia. I mean, Russia is a reality for this country. He refused to take a position on behalf of the Ukrainians in the war with the Russians. And part of the ugly atmosphere in the Slovak Republic is around this issue of Europe, Russia, and so on. But there's also other things involved. It's not clear why this lone wolf went up to him and shot him. But the shooting happened in the context of new advances being made by Russian forces in the Kharkiv region. What the Russians have been doing is holding the line in Donetsk now for several months. There's been very little change in the line there. But by coming in from the north and striking the northern villages and towns north of Kharkiv in Orotseve and Krasnaye and so on, where they made advances on May 11th and May 14th, coming very close, across the border, but very close to big urban areas. This is, if they have a breakthrough, they are in Kharkiv within, a couple of days, they could be there. They're doing this, I think, in preparation for the arrival of new U.S. weaponry. While the Ukrainians are without this weaponry, I think the Russians are trying to make gains in Kharkiv to prevent a Ukrainian assault in the Donbas region. There's a lot of confusion, both in this conflict where there really should have been a peace agreement a long time ago and a debate and discussion about the various security challenges being faced by all sides. The Russians, of course, saying that they had been shut out by the Biden administration. When Biden first came to power, closed the door to talk to the Russians about their anxiety over the security situation. There's been lots of space for dialogue and discussion, simply not on the table as far as the United States is concerned. Mr. Putin, meanwhile, is making a state visit to China. He was greeted below the steps of the presidential palace where he met with Xi Jinping. Xi Jinping came down the stairs to greet him. This is a big sign of their closeness. I'm not sure exactly what they will be talking about apart from increasing trade and increasing the integration between Russia and China, but I'm sure that the issue of Ukraine will be on the table for them to talk about. Russia has just put forward a new defense minister, Andrei Belousov, who comes from a Russian military family. He has been a very close person with Mr. Putin. He's been his deputy prime minister, his advisor, his economics development minister, and so on. Very close to Mr. Putin. Changing the defense minister in the midst of a war is always a signal of something. Not sure exactly what Mr. Andrei Belousov will bring to the table, but it's a sign that the Russians feel that they have the momentum with them, at least until the U.S. weaponry arrives. If they make gains in the Kharkiv region, perhaps that will force the Ukrainians to come to the table. Who knows? We hope so, because, of course, war is an abomination for humanity. You're with Give the People What They Want, brought to you today by Zoe from People's Dispatch. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. We started the show announcing that Probit Purkasta has been free. At some point, of course, we're going to come back and talk at much more length on the Indian elections, which are ongoing. And I know that many of you want to know about what's happening in India. See you next week.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome.